It probably is a sign for the person introducing the speaker that a crowd of this kind suggests there's no need for an introduction. And we did send you information about the various awards that this national award-winning journalist has achieved for consistency, consistently best column, for best business and financial columnist, for best commentary, and so on. So his stature has gone before him. One indication, though, of something that may be less well-known would be to cite just a couple of sentences from a piece he wrote in 1996. And somehow one thought not only was he describing the spirit of Adam Smith, but some aspects of his own approach. And he called Smith a man of our times, or ought to be. This is less because free markets, because he championed free markets, than that he cared so much about more than free markets. Free markets are only a means to an end. Government was another, and Smith constantly probed the proper rules. We could use his spirit today because we seem to have arrived at the opposite mix sometimes, surplus self-righteousness and scarce wisdom. And he was long on wisdom and short on self-righteousness. Liberals are so protective of government that they cannot concede the great power of Smith's invisible hand. Self-interest is not simply greed, selfishness, or narcissism. If properly constrained, it is an immense force for social good. And then Smith's words, it is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. Meanwhile, he says, conservatives are so contemptuous of government that they cannot admit that it often is more than a necessary evil. It creates the legal and political framework without which tolerably free markets could not survive. It also supplies the collective services from defense to roads. And in Smith's own approach, three vital roles: defense, ensuring justice and protecting property, and third, building roads, canals, harbors, and infrastructure. He speaks of the fact that underlying it all is the quest for a civilizing influence. Smith believed in the primacy of the family as a moral force, the place where children learn self-control, and as a source of personal happiness. So it's that breadth and that vision that I think make all of us read him with considerable faithfulness, and we're delighted that he would talk about does the new economy need a tax increase.
Thank you, Ken. I'm going to stand up. Is that all right?
Okay,
with you?
Sure.
All right. I don't know why I'm going to stand up. It's just usually when I talk, I stand up. Is this microphone working? Okay. I must say I'm a little bit stunned here. The last time I talked, I think there were a few people along this row and a few people along this row. And I don't know, maybe it's because of the snow, and I canceled the last time I was supposed to be down here. So I'm a little bit surprised there are so many people here. And I appreciate you all coming out. I thank Ken for the invitation. I've always thought that Ken ought to be the Secretary of State, because I think he could convince almost anybody to do anything. And that if there was strife or disagreement or conflict in any part of the world, they'd just send Ken off and he would get the parties down together, and he would get them together no matter how long and how ferociously they hated each other. But you're here, and the University of Virginia is certainly a lot better off for it. But anyway, appreciate the invitation. Now, when we talked some many months ago about what I should talk about, I wanted to have a subject that was so general that I could talk about almost anything. So that we came up with the title, Does the New Economy Need a Tax Cut? Which would allow me to talk about the budget if I want to talk about the budget. It would allow me to talk about the new economy if I want to talk about the new economy. And will allow me to put them together if circumstances and timing seem to call for that. Well, circumstances and timing do seem to call for that. It's actually a very apt and timely subject, although it didn't necessarily seem so back in the fall when we talked about this. Now, I actually want to talk less about the tax cut. And I'm not going to create any suspense here. I do think the new economy needs a tax cut, but I will get to that at the end. And I mostly want to talk about the new economy. Let me just say that in audiences, as a preface before I do, in audiences, when I look out and I see the average age may be, say, under 35, I no longer give this little preamble because they don't need it. But I see that the age here might be 37 or 38, so I'm going to give it. I am not Paul Samuelson's son, brother, cousin. I am not related to Paul Samuelson. He does, however, have a son whose name is Robert J. Samuelson, so there's obvious some confusion. But so anything that I say here, I think I gave the same disclaimer the last time I talked here, should not be held against Paul Samuelson, who, after all, has a Nobel Prize in economics. All right, I want to talk about the new economy for a while then. People talk about the new economy as if it was a reality, when in my view it is actually just a phrase. If you ask its advocates what the new economy means, you never really get an exacting or really critical definition. Again, in my view, the new economy never really existed. It has only been a state of mind, a mood of almost boundless optimism. Now, if pressed, the advocates of the new economy, I think, would defend it as follows. We have entered a wonderland of new technologies, mainly computers and communications advances that promise to propel economic and social progress for the foreseeable future. We will have rising living standards because these new technologies have fostered an explosion in productivity and efficiency. Wages and salaries and profits will all rise as a result of higher productivity. The higher stock market is, or at least was until a little while ago, justified by these higher expected future profits. And if people are taking on more debts, as in fact they have been through most of the late 1990s and into the new century, it too is justified because future incomes will be higher than people expected only 6 or 7 years ago, and therefore the ability to repay these debts will be greater than people expected. Not only was the stock market boom, or has been the stock market boom and higher borrowing justified by the explosion of new productivity, new technologies, and the accompanying productivity, but the same technologies reduced the risk of inflation and recessions because they increased efficiency of corporations and the business sector will allow them to increase wages and profits and salaries without increasing prices. And over much of the post-war period, especially since the 1960s, rising inflation has been a proximate cause of recessions. Inflation rises, the Federal Reserve increases interest rates to choke off the rising inflation, we go into a business slump or a slowdown, and so if you are able to somehow minimize or even eliminate these inflationary pressures, you will have minimized the dangers of slowdowns or recessions. In short, these new technologies created a new world for economic thinking because they allowed us to enjoy higher living standards and essentially perpetual or almost perpetual prosperity. And if you look at the economy over the last 10 years, you will see that, in fact, there is a fair amount, in my view, of superficial evidence that will support this view of the new economy. First, whereas in previous economic expansions, we have experienced rising inflation as the expansion got longer and as labor markets tightened up and there were pressure for higher wages and as product markets tightened up and there were pressure for higher prices, in this expansion, we have not experienced dramatically higher inflation. Let me just give you some numbers. In 1991, at the beginning of this latest expansion, and the end of the last recession, consumer prices rose 3.1%. In 1995, they rose 2.5%. In 1999, they rose 2.7%. And in 2000, they only rose 3.4%, despite a surge in higher energy costs. So inflation has been remarkably well behaved in this economic expansion compared to other economic expansions. Second, the fundamental premise of a new economy, that we are experiencing increasing rates of productivity growth, and productivity growth is just a $64 word for greater efficiency. You can do more with less, or you can do more with a given amount of investment. Workers are more productive. Productivity just means efficiency. So efficiency, productivity has increased, at least by the statistics. Between 1995 and 2000, productivity, which is technically defined as the output per worker hour, rose about 3%, double the rate between 1993 and 1995, which was only 1.5%. And finally, the economic boom just went on and on. It continued and continued and defied forecasts of people like me who thought that the business cycle was a permanent part of the economic scene, and that sooner or later we would have to enter a downturn. The previous record, historic record, for an economic expansion in American history, this is all of American history, going back to the Revolution, even before the Revolution, was 106 months, as I recall, in the 1960s, from early 1961 to late 1969. We surpassed that a while ago. If the economy is still expanding, we are now at 10 years. So again, this has been the longest economic expansion in American history. It's experienced rising rates of productivity growth, no huge obvious problem with inflation. And meanwhile, the last bit of good news, unemployment has fallen to levels that only 3 or 4 years ago, most economists would have considered, 5 years ago perhaps, most economists would have considered impossible without rising levels of inflation. Again, let me just give you some numbers. In 1996, unemployment was 5.4%. In 97, it was 4.9%. In 98, it was 4.5%, and so on down to 4% last year. Economists have had a concept which they call the NARU, or the natural rate of unemployment, which essentially says that at some rate of unemployment, you get sufficiently tight labor markets where the competition for labor begins to raise the level of wages, and that feeds into prices. So when you hit that level of unemployment, you basically generate inflation. Most economists in the early 90s and even in the mid-90s considered the NARU, or the natural rate of unemployment, to be somewhere between 5 and 6%. The optimists were closer to 5%, the pessimists were closer to 6%, and they essentially said, this is as good as it can get. If you get down below that rate, it's going to be self-defeating, because you'll get a temporary dip in unemployment, then inflation will shoot up, you'll have a recession, and you'll have to pay back all the lower unemployment you had in a burst of higher unemployment, and maybe even more. So, at least in a statistical sense, the new economy seems to have disproved this notion of the natural rate of unemployment. So if there's so much evidence that the new economy actually conforms to the predictions and the descriptions of its advocates, why am I so skeptical about it? Well, let me just say at the outset, or now at the midset, that I may be wrong. I have been wrong often in my career. I try to forget my mistakes. I usually repeat them, but I may be wrong. And the prophets of the new economy may well be right, and it may be that we have actually entered a new era that requires new intellectual framework to understand it. The jury is out, so to speak, to use a cliche. However, the recent carnage in the stock market suggests at least the possibility that skeptics like myself may ultimately turn out to be right, and that we have no new economy, that we simply have an extension of the old economy, which is always changing, in which there are always new technologies and new products, and in which people's and enterprises' behavior is always shifting somewhat based on their own experience and what they judge the economic climate to be. So again, let me now give you some evidence, in my view, of why this wonderful vision of the new economy is somewhat romantic. First, in my view, the advocates of the new economy have been guilty of historic amnesia. It is certainly true that the computers, personal computers, and the internet are great inventions. I just add as an aside that I do use a personal computer. I do go on the internet. I still do all my writing on a manual typewriter, which strikes me as a superior bit of technology for actually writing. But I have been dragged into the cyber age somewhat unwillingly, but I do use a computer. So this is not simply personal hostility on my part to the technology. But as great as the internet and the personal computer are, people have seemed to have forgotten that there were other great new technologies. There were other great new inventions. And in my view, many of these past inventions and technologies have had a much more profound effect on daily life and indeed on the economic structure than at least so far the internet and the personal computer have. And I will just mention a few of the very obvious, simple candidates. The automobile, electricity, antibiotics, and the entire complex of modern pharmaceuticals, air travel, the steam engine, synthetic fibers, and one can go on. These were all great breakthroughs. They had profound economic, social, political implications for societies as they went through them. And in my view, the internet is not yet in this category. Even if you look at the impact of technology and changing management on the productivity figures, you discover that these last 5 years of rapid productivity growth are hardly unprecedented. At the end of World War II until the early 90s, from 1947 to 1973, productivity growth, again, that's output per hour worked, grew at an average rate of 3.3%. So again, compared to the recent experience in the early post-war period, productivity growth was greater, and the greater rates of productivity growth were maintained for a longer period of time. So just as a factual matter, there's nothing new historically about what we've been through in the last 5 years, it seems to me. A second bit of historical amnesia involves the nature of business downturns, recessions, slowdowns, slumps, whatever label you want to give to it. The perception and the belief is that the higher inflation is a precipitating cause of recessions. And indeed, it has been in recent history, in the last 20 or 30 years. But in theory and practice, it is not the only conceivable cause of a recession or a slowdown. In my view, and I'm not an economist, I'm just a journalist, but in my view, what history teaches us is that recessions occur when some sort of substantial imbalance occurs in the economy that cannot continue. And at some point, when it's either an imbalance of spending or an imbalance of prices or whatever, or some scarcity, that triggers a slowdown in the economy. It can be excessive consumption, in other words, consumption that can't be sustained forever, or excessive investment. In other words, people are investing in things that is not actually needed. A typical example would be real estate investment, where there's overbuilding of homes or office buildings or shopping malls and shopping centers. And when the developers discover that lo and behold, there are no tenants or there are no buyers for the things they have built, they stop building them because they can't repay their loans and the lenders won't lend them anymore. That's a kind of typical excess in investment, but it's not the only conceivable excess in investment. So theoretically, it seems to me, just because we may have perhaps temporarily, perhaps permanently, managed to keep inflation under control, does not necessarily mean that we are invulnerable to recessions. You have to remember during the early post-war years when we were experiencing these large increases in productivity, and we actually had very stable prices, meaning our measured inflation rate was very low, we had periodic recessions. We had a recession in the late 40s. We had another recession in 53, 54 after the Korean War. We had another recession in 57, 58. We had a recession, a mild one, in 1960 and early 61. So recessions can occur and have occurred in the past, even though inflation rates have been very modest. Now, if that's theoretically possible and historically true, you might ask, do we now face potential imbalances in the economy that could conceivably lead to a slowdown or even a recession? And in my view, the answer is yes. There are two very large imbalances in the current economy. The first is business investment. During the 1990s and the early part of the new century, there has been an explosion in business investment. In 1991, business investment essentially was 9.1% of gross domestic product, which is the measure of our economy. By last year, it was 15%. So it had been growing substantially faster than the overall economy. And as everyone intuitively knows, a large part of this investment has gone into these new technologies, computers, communications networks, software, and the like. Again, the figures are somewhat astonishing. In 1990, computers, communications, gear, software, related high technology investments accounted for roughly 33% of business spending on new equipment. Last year, they accounted for almost 60%. So much of the investment boom has not been driven by the things that people of my age and probably your age consider traditional investments, factories, office buildings, the like. They've been driven by companies putting in new computers, new fiber optic systems going into the ground, and factories for all these things, people writing software to make these things run and talk to each other. That has been the mainstay of the investment boom in the 1990s. And it is, again, the faith that these new technologies are creating higher productivity that is the underlying foundation for the theory of the new economy. But again, in my view, much of this investment in recent years, probably not in the mid-1990s, maybe not even through 97 or 98, but in the last 3 or 4 years, in my view, much of this new investment has been wasted. It's unproductive. It's not profitable. And therefore, the investment boom is not sustainable. Now, do we know this for a fact? We do not know it for a fact, or at least I don't know it for a fact. But there seems to me there's a fair amount of circumstantial evidence out there. The most obvious bit of circumstantial evidence is the whole dot-com phenomenon, where you had all these websites that 18 months ago looked to be the future of the universe. And now many of them, not all of them, are out of business. But it seems to me there are probably many other aspects of this communications and computer boom that we don't see very well that are probably unproductive. Large companies putting in new systems for which they had expected rates of return, internal rates of return, that are not actually happening. But they felt that they had large cash flows, this was the wave of the future, and they had to compete against these new dot-coms or whatever, so they made these investments. We are now seeing a pullback by many of these large corporations as well. An example I used in a column some weeks ago was Disney, which is basically they had a portal, an internet portal called GoCom, and they are basically shutting that down. Over the last year, their cash loss on their internet operations was $250 million. This is actually a fair amount of money, even for a company like Disney. The company for which I work, the Washington Post Company, has set up a very good website. I don't know how much they lost last year on it. They certainly lost. The year before, they lost $85 million. That's a lot of money for a company like ours, which is much smaller than Disney. I have a friend who works at the Washington Post as an executive, and he's in charge of all their new business operations. So when I see him, I call him vice president in charge of losses. He does not appreciate this. There is other circumstantial evidence, and let me just tick off some indicators of the internet and how productive it is or isn't, or how large a role it plays in our economy. In 2000, online retail sales were $26 billion, which sounds like a lot, but it's actually less than 1% of total retail sales of $3.2 trillion. You have to remember, we are in a $10 trillion economy. Internet advertising is essentially stagnated at about $8 or $9 billion, and that's about 4% of all advertising. Online airline bookings have been very strong. They've risen extremely rapidly, but despite their rapid growth, they still represent only 9% of all airline bookings. And my suspicion is that at least some of the efficiencies here are not what I would call real economic efficiencies. They involve, for airline bookings I'm talking about now, they involve essentially shifting the work of the travel agent to the prospective passenger. Travel agent now gets 5% if they roughly 5% if they do a ticket for you. You go up online, you may spend a half an hour or 45 minutes doing what the travel agent does. You don't get paid for it, you get a cut, perhaps. But essentially, what the airline is doing is they're cutting out the middlemen, imposing some cost and time on you, and giving you a cheaper ticket in return. So some of the gains from internet airline booking, it seems to me, are probably real. Some of them are simply cutting out the middleman and imposing some cost on the passenger. And finally, online stock trading. Again, that has done very well in terms of growth. There, 8 or 9 years ago, there were essentially no online accounts. There are now, in 2000, an estimated 18 million of them. But still, that's much less than traditional accounts, which are 60 million, which is only down 1 million over the last few years. So despite the rapid growth in online trading, the traditional account still is the major form in which people deal with their own investments. Now, business investment, in my view, simply will not continue if it cannot earn a return. And much of this recent investment is not earning a return. And as a result, I don't think we should be surprised that we are hearing announcements day after day after day, really beginning at the end of last year, from companies that have been at the forefront of this new technology boom, that their sales, their earnings, are below expectations. Companies like Cisco, Nortel, Lucent, Oracle, Intel. Again, the investment boom, in my view, will not be sustained unless the new investments can earn a return. So we should expect to see either a dramatic slowdown in investment, or it is quite conceivable to me, actual declines in investment. That's the one large imbalance that afflicts our current economy, in my view. A second large imbalance is consumer spending, which, like investment spending, has exploded over the last decade. Put very simply, Americans have been spending their incomes, have been spending much faster than their incomes have been rising over the last decade. The statistical way of measuring this is by using something called the personal savings rate, which is the percentage of people's after-tax income which they save. Now, in 1992, the personal savings rate was roughly 9%, meaning that almost 9% of every dollar of after-tax income was saved. That's a collective figure. Some people didn't save anything. Some people surely saved much more than 9%. But when you put it all together, it's roughly 9%. In the year 2000, it was zero. Collectively, Americans did not save anything. They either borrowed, they cashed in stock profits, and spent those stock profits, so they basically were spending more than they were earning that year, or they stopped saving because their existing stock accounts were going up more than they expected, so their wealth was greater than expected, so they didn't think they had to put in the money that they were usually putting in. But one way or another, collectively, personal savings dropped to zero. Now, in my view, this cannot go on forever. We cannot, as a society, spend everything we earn year after year, and we certainly can't continue to spend increasingly large amounts of the money that we don't earn year after year. Remember, it's not simply that we're spending more, spending every penny we've earned last year, but that savings rate had declined. So we were increasing our spending faster than our income. So I want to quote the great economist Herb Stein, who taught here for many years, who maybe have been a friend of yours, who was certainly one of the funniest people in his profession, and I think also one of the, he was rooted in reality. Stein's law holds that if something cannot go on indefinitely, it will stop. This cannot go on indefinitely. Sooner or later, it will stop, and in my view, it is in the process now of stopping. It may have already stopped. So we have these two great imbalances in our economy. We have overinvestment, in my view, and we have over-consumer spending, or overspending by consumers. If they both slow down simultaneously, or even decline, then the economy is, by definition, in a lot of trouble. Consumer spending is roughly two-thirds of total spending in the economy. Business investment is another 15 or 16%. You're up now over 80%. You're dealing with four-fifths of the economy, which may be slowing down, facing possible declines. And there is, as you all will appreciate, the possibility of a vicious circle, that as the slowdown occurs, companies' profits and expectations of profits worsen, the stock market goes down, that spooks people. To try to restore their profits, companies lay off people. That spooks people further. Their consumer spending no longer becomes so exuberant, and that feeds into this whole process of declining confidence, declining spending, rising unemployment. I'm not saying it's a kind of has to spiral down forever until there's no one left employed, but I'm saying at least at the beginning of a business cycle, a business downturn, that is a danger, and we are on the cusp of that right now, in my view. So you have 80% or more of the economy which is potentially facing a slowdown or recession. What is to pull the economy out of this or put a floor under the decline? Well, the last 20% essentially consists of three things. One is exports, net exports, technically. And if the rest of the world isn't particularly strong, we can't expect to be saved by their demand for our products. And it seems to me that anyone looking around the world cannot be reassured. The Japanese economy is in terrible shape and has been in terrible shape really for the last 8 or 9 years. The European economy is in somewhat better shape, but it's not in great shape. And developing countries, particularly in Asia and in Latin America, are very dependent on exports to the United States. And essentially, I think, on the confidence that the United States and the boom in the United States have created for the world economy. So there is a real question mark as to whether exports can provide much stimulus for the American economy. There's housing. But it seems to me if you have declining consumer confidence, it's unlikely you're going to get a housing boom because people don't take on long-term commitments when they're afraid of the future. And finally, there is government. And now we come back to the question that Ken posed at the outset, do we need a tax cut? Well, if the government is intent on running up bigger and bigger surpluses, on taking more and more money out of the economy, it too will act as a depressing force on economic growth. So the answer, my answer is, at this point, we have to cut taxes. Now, I in the past have been, I wrote three or four years ago, that as these surpluses developed, the first thing we ought to do with them is not do anything with them. We just ought to pay down the debt. In an ideal world, we would use the surpluses to pay down the debt. But all these surpluses that are projected out for however long you want to project them, these surpluses do not exist. These are simply calculations that people have put on paper based on a series of assumptions which more likely than not will turn out to be wrong. And one way they will turn out to be wrong is that the economy will not be nearly as healthy as we had thought and hoped it would be. So if you refrain from giving a tax cut today because you want to preserve the surpluses of the future, you will, it seems to me, very much run, you take a gamble. And the gamble is that somehow things are going to continue as you had expected them to continue, and the economy doesn't need any help from an outside source. So in my view, the economy does need a tax cut based on this very simple logic of most of the forces that propel the economy forward are now weakening or perhaps declining, and if we don't somehow boost either government spending, which I think is not in the cards, just given the philosophy of the current administration, or help consumers resume their own spending by giving them a little bit more money, then the dangers of a prolonged slowdown or recession, it seems to me, are much greater. Having said that, and I'm about to end here, having said that, I don't think that the tax cut proposal that the President, President Bush, has sent up is the tax cut proposal that we need at this moment. Back in January, I wrote a column, and I basically believe now what I believed then, it's not that long ago, that what we ought to do if we're deciding on essentially a fairly ideal policy is that we ought to take the centerpiece of his proposal, which is lower tax rates and the expansion of so-called child credit. He would expand it from $500 to $1,000. And we ought to implement those things immediately. I would modify his tax proposal. He would reduce the top tax rate from income tax rate from 39.6 to 33. I think that's a little bit, I'm all in favor of the rich and all that, but I think that's a little bit generous. I would just knock that down to 35%, and I would use the other money to sort of spread it over the lower income bracket somehow. This would have the paradoxical effect of reducing the total cost of Bush's, of the tax cut Congress would be passed, but increasing the amounts that become available to people immediately and would help revive the economy. I think that that is a sensible and prudent way to go forward. The kind of tax cut that I propose is not the only kind you could have, but it does seem to me to be effective. You have to have a permanent tax cut. You have to tell the people who are getting it that this is what taxes are going to be. We're not going to change it again in 18 months, or we're not going to just put this into effect for a year until we see what happens. But you have to give some people some sense that they can actually spend this money permanently, because it's not going to be sort of revoked 18 months or 2 years from now if Congress is of a different mind. Anyway, I've talked a little bit longer than I had expected to. I noticed that not too many of you have gone to sleep, and I appreciate that. I once gave a talk in Japan, and I am going to finish in a second. And they said, well, we'd like to talk you to talk for an hour and a half. And I said, I couldn't conceivably talk for an hour and a half on anything. But even if I could, I can't imagine that anybody would want to listen to me for an hour and a half. And so I said, the longest I'm going to talk is 45 minutes. But it didn't make any difference. Before I'd even opened my mouth, half the audience was asleep. So I'm glad to see that that is not the case here. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Thank you very much.
Who would like to begin the discussion?
One over here, Ken.
Yes.
If part of the idea of stimulating the economy and doing it early rather than having the backloaded taxes and bringing it forward, all that, why isn't there more conversation toward reducing the capital gains tax, which would, if there's so many people invested in the market and so on, why wouldn't that be an early stimulus?
Well, I think there are two answers to that. There's a political answer and an economic answer. The political answer is that Bush is already doing an awful lot for the wealthy and well-to-do. He's proposing to eliminate the estate tax, which benefits a very small sliver. It will be an increasing, as my generation gets to retirement, It's going to be increasingly large sliver, but it's still going to be a sliver. We're not talking about 70% of the population. He has proposed reducing the top income tax rate, which affects a very small sliver of the population. Now, although stock holdings have increased dramatically over the last decade, and my recollection is that in 1989, about 32% of families, households, owned stock, and now it's roughly half. Despite that, the proportion of stock that is held by the very wealthy is very high. So politically, you would simply be doing one more thing for this group that is not the most popular in the country. There's also, it seems to me, an economic reason for this, although I don't know where this is figured at all. In a down market, if you cut the capital gains rate, you're basically telling people to sell. Because one of the reasons that people don't sell is they don't like to pay capital gains. If you cut the capital gains rate, if you just take the hypothetical situation where there is no capital gains rate at all, well, you incur, the only penalty you incur for selling is the loss in case the market might go up. But if it really looks like the market is weak or you become more risk averse, it seems to me that lowering or removing the capital gains rate will actually give the market the wrong signal at the wrong time. I'm not sure that that enters in the calculation at all. But my gut feeling is that the main reason is even Bush could not overload his tax package too much with things that benefit this very, I wouldn't say it's a very unpopular group, but if we go into a recession and unemployment begins going up and you give a large tax cut and you can show, as you will be able to show statistically, that 40, 50% is going to people with incomes over $200,000, this is not a political winner. And congressional Republicans are talking about this. I'm real skeptical that'll get into a final package. And I don't think it will do the economy much good if it does. But having said all this, my own view is that what we did in 1986 was the right thing. We brought down total rates. We aligned the capital gains rate with other rates so that you couldn't game the system by going back and forth. That was the right policy. Unfortunately, this is one of his least recognized, most destructive legacies. Bill Clinton destroyed the 86 Tax Reform Act. He did it deliberately, in my view. Nobody in the press ever paid any attention to this. I wrote three or four columns about this. But you raise tax rates, which is what he did. You increase all the kind of different preferences that people can have. And you've basically gone back to the pre-1986 system of high rates, lots of deductions and credits, and basically using the tax system as an overt, energetic, political apparatus to distribute benefits. And we just renamed tax breaks to targeted tax breaks, and that's what they're called now. They're considered good, but we used to consider them loopholes or breaks. And we had this one moment where we actually tried to simplify the tax system. And unfortunately, it's gone and probably will never be retrieved.
Robert or I will try to repeat the question for those in the hinterland outside. Who'd like to ask the next question?
Do you think that it appears to me, at least, that you think that the Bush can get the tax cut through the Senate without these triggers, which fly in the face of a permanent tax cut?
I do think there will be a tax cut this year. I don't think it will be Bush's plan. I don't think he probably thinks it will be his plan. I think it will contain elements of his plan. I would be very surprised if there was not some sort of across-the-board tax cut. I doubt that the top rate will go from 39.6 to 33. It may not come down at all, but my guess is that there will be some reduction in tax rates. I'm a little bit, let me just back up. The fundamental problem here for Bush is this. Since late last year and beginning of this year, he has tried to sell this plan essentially as an anti-recessionary tool. he cited the weakening economy, and I think that that's entirely appropriate. The trouble is, the tax plan that he's proposed doesn't do what he's now selling it as. His tax proposal was essentially a political proposal, and I don't mean political in a bad sense. He believes, and I happen to agree with a large part of his philosophy, he believes that if you don't reduce this surplus by reducing taxes, the alternative, as a practical matter, is not simply paying down the debt, it's increasing spending. And between reducing taxes and giving it back to the people who earned it, and increasing spending, he would prefer to reduce taxes. That's a political judgment reflecting a political philosophy. And the fact that the taxes are skewed toward the high end reflects the reality that the high end of the income spectrum pays the overwhelming majority of federal taxes. So they get back what they paid. Having now changed his sales pitch to making this an anti-recessionary device, he's got this contradiction. He's peddling this political tax package as an anti-recessionary device when it isn't. In the first year, the tax cut amounts to $5.6 billion. Well, $5.6 billion is a lot to you and me, but in a $10 trillion economy, it is noise. It isn't going to do anything. No one thinks it would do anything. So it seems to me in the White House, they have got to make a decision fairly quickly, or they should make a decision fairly quickly, in my view, to try to marry his political objectives with something that is plausibly effective as an anti-recessionary device. And I think they can do that, but so far they haven't shown any inclination to do it. And my guess is, I have no inside information, that the reason they haven't done it is they've underestimated the seriousness of the economic slowdown or recession that might occur. So they don't see any real sense of urgency. They may talk about a sense of urgency, but they don't feel it. And the second thing is that they think that the climate is on their side, and that if the economy weakens somewhat, there will be a clamor for a tax cut, and people really won't know the difference between their proposal and something that would be more calibrated to help the economy. I think that that's a miscalculation. I don't think that that will be proven right. So there will be a tax cut, but it won't be Bush's, but it will contain elements of his. That's all I know. That's my best guess.
Given that the government is not a family and the debt that we owe as a government includes both capital and operating expenses incurred over time, what's your view of the proper amount of permanent debt the federal government should carry and or pay off and approach that problem?
Well, I'm not an economist, as I said, so I don't know the answer to that. Moreover, I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. I think that when you get to some level of debt, even in a society like the United States, which has the most productive economy in the world, which has the deepest capital markets, and has the most stable form of government in the world, it seems to me, at some point, people begin doubting that the government can pay off its debt without inflating its way out of it. And at that point, interest rates rise dramatically. You've seen this in smaller societies where the debt levels gets higher, and people simply doubt the government's ability. They don't doubt that they can get paper for their debts. They just doubt whether the paper that they're going to get is going to be worth anything. So to compensate for that risk, they add a premium to the interest rate, and at that point, debt is no longer a useful tool against recession, because the more debt you issue, the higher interest rates go. So you basically deprived yourself of a tool. Now, I don't think we are anywhere close to that right now. My passion for reducing the debt basically has to do with the future level of government spending. I am 55. I am at the very edge of the baby boom. when we start to retire, government spending is going to go up. And it's going to go up a lot, in my view. It's going to go up more than the projections, because we are, I don't want to be too negative here, but we're somewhat self-centered, maybe even greedy generation. And as we get closer to our so-called golden years, we are going to discover lots of things that the government can be doing for us, or lots of things that the government's doing to us that we don't like, and we're going to try to get rid of those things. And we're going to try to get the stuff out of our tax-free retirement accounts tax-free. We've had them all these years in IRAs and KEOs and 401 tax-free, and we're going to discover, my God, the government's going to tax them when we take them out. We're not going to like that. And I predict that there will be pressure to further enhance that. There's going to be obviously and perhaps desirably pressure to add long-term care benefits to Medicare or more to Medicaid or create some new program. We're already seeing pressures for a Medicare drug benefit, which in some ways are entirely justifiable. So in my view, federal spending is going to go up in the future. And so what I want to do, if economic circumstances permit it, is I want to pay down as much of the existing debt as possible to reduce the interest rate burden that our children will have to pay in addition to subsidizing us in retirement. But if you ask, is there some theoretical level at which we can run up the debt, I don't know it, I don't think anybody knows it, but we're not there yet, and we can run up the debt a lot more before we get to it.
Would you give us your view of the impact, if any, of the Fed's reducing rates will have on the kind of moving forecast?
Well, reducing rates?
Yeah, in other words, can the Fed essentially undo all the awful things that I've prophesized, or at least implied? And I should have, in my talk, have said that this very strong, I would say almost religious belief in the Fed is really part of the ideology of the new economy. And I think it is self-defeating. When people begin believing that you have created a system in which there is no danger of setback, people become less risk-averse, they become less prudent, they begin doing things that basically create problems that are going to cause some sort of a setback. And that's a fundamental, it seems to me, contradiction of the new economy theology. To answer your question, I hope that, in fact, lower interest rates will have the desired effect. I have a piece in Newsweek this week. I'll go out and buy Newsweek, get as many subscribers as we can get. That raises some skepticism about how quickly lower interest rates will help. There are a number of channels through which lower interest rates are supposed to work. The most obvious one is lower interest rates encourages people to borrow more, encourages businesses to borrow more. But essentially, at the end of a 10-year economic expansion, if indeed we are at the end of it, households have already run up their debts to very high levels. Businesses have run up, in the case of households, to historically high levels. Businesses have run up their debts quite a bit, not to historically high levels, but to close to them. And so it's quite plausible, to me at least, that even as the Federal Reserve reduces interest rates, households and businesses will want to reduce their level of debt rather than borrowing more in these circumstances. So that won't work. Another plausible avenue through which the lower interest rates will help is by increasing consumer purchasing power through refinancing of mortgages and also, to some extent, adjustable rate debt that people have. And this will help. But it's possible that it will help a lot less than people think it will help. Economists at Goldman Sachs say that last year, the average mortgage rate was about 7.4%. The average mortgage rate today is about 7%. They did the arithmetic, and they say if you look at where it makes sense for people to refinance, perhaps the increase in disposable income, after-tax disposable income, be about $6 billion. That's 0.1% of disposable income. That is not going to automatically lift the economy up. another possible channel through which monetary policy, lower interest rates, is supposed to work is by reducing the dollar's exchange rate, which makes our exports more competitive in the world. But so far, the Fed has reduced interest rates. The dollar hasn't weakened very much. One of the reasons the dollar hasn't weakened very much is Japan, the Japanese economy is not great, so people don't want to put their money in yen. European economy is not that great, so people don't want to put their money in euros. You know, we'll see whether that happens, but so far it hasn't happened. So my own view is that the outsized faith in the Federal Reserve has been somewhat overdone. I think they're going to have to reduce interest rates much more than most economists think. The economists I've talked to say, well, they're expected to reduce the so-called Fed funds rate to 5% tomorrow, which is another half point. And I've economists say, well, they'll have to go down to 4.5%. Some say 4. My guess is they'll be below 4, maybe down to 3. I mean, I think they're going to have to really pump money into this economy sooner or later. But that's just my gut feeling. And let me just append everything I've said. I've been pessimistic, really, since 1978. And I want to point out, I mean, 1998, sorry. Between 1978 and 1998, I was optimistic. I kept saying the problems of the economy are not so bad. They're not as bad as everybody's. The performance of the U.S. economy is much better than all the boomer and doomers. And I wrote a book about it. Please go out and buy it. The Good Life and Its Discontent. It was published in 1995. But beginning in 1998, this all just became kind of incomprehensible to me. But the point I want to make is, for most of the time between 1998 and now, I have been wrong. So it's possible I am still wrong, and that these other people were right. And I mean, I say that seriously. I don't. This is just my gut feeling. I could be wrong.
This is the last question, okay. I guess.
I am usually an opponent of increased government spending because so much of it is targeted towards specific groups, and everyone gets their cut, their share. But I wonder if enough is being done for providing for quality of life over the broad spectrum of the whole populace. The cities are deteriorating. The infrastructure is falling apart in the cities. Nothing is, and the plumbing is all the same age. You know, deep down underneath, things are exploding in Washington, D.C., under the streets. Is anybody coming up with a program? And it seems like, to me, this would be a great way to infuse the economy with a good government spending program that would provide for your children and everyone and make life in the future look
better,
more optimistic.
Well, I...
and public transport mass transport, getting the trucks off.
What about a government spending program to deal with our problems at the time?
And she mentions two. One is the sort of the infrastructure of the city, meaning the pipes, the roads, the bridges, that sort of stuff. And the second would be more mass transit. Well, let me start with mass transit because it's the one where I think the answer is the simplest, and that is most mass transit benefits the people who are using it. That's simple, but it means it's local. This is not a national issue. And if you start handing out money from Washington, and we do hand out money from Washington, very liberal amounts of money from Washington for mass transit systems, what you find is that localities, based on their political influence, are able to get large grants to build what are tremendously inefficient mass transit systems. Los Angeles is building one now. My guess is that it will do very little to reduce congestion in Los Angeles, but it's costing billions of dollars, and a lot of it is coming from Washington. My guess is that people in California or Los Angeles would have never done this if they had to pay for every penny of it. A friend of mine who lives in Seattle says they're on the verge of doing something out in Seattle, and she's actually, you know, kind of a liberal person. I'm not too liberal myself, but she is, but she thinks this is nuts. And it is probably nuts. Probably nuts because there's also, we now know, an earthquake fault out there. But almost certainly, in my view, and I haven't done any reporting on this, people in Seattle would not be doing this if they had to pay for it themselves. And since they're going to get all the benefits, none of the benefits of this are going to go to people in Montana or people in New York. It seems to me that is a particularly local issue that ought to be paid for by the taxpayers in that state.
But if it keeps people living in Seattle instead of moving to Montana and ruining the countryside, doesn't it kind of benefit us all?
Well, that's a good argument. That's certainly a good argument. And you would have to ask yourself, will it keep people living in Seattle? And my guess is if you actually sat down and really very critically, but not in a biased way, figured out how many people will this keep living in Seattle, you would discover that the cost per person was tens, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars. That when I decide I'm going to move someplace, the number of factors that enter into my mind as to why I'm going to move, probably 50 or 100, from the schools to my job to my marriage, and probably my commuting time is fairly far down on that because I can always move within the metropolitan area, perhaps, if I'm dissatisfied with my commuting time. And there may not be a job in Montana for me. So the people who are actually capable of moving to Montana are probably going to move anyway, and they may not be using mass transit. So I have to say I am somewhat skeptical of programs like this because although they sound good on paper or they sound good when you propose them in practice, they don't always turn out. But if we have a deep economic downturn, I think it's quite conceivable we'll see proposals like that. And then people like me ought to step back and try to have an open mind and see whether they make sense.
A couple of words about the truth and the untruth. Copies, we believe, of the book Untruth, Why the Conventional Wisdom is almost always in parentheses wrong. Of the most current book by our speaker should be, but life is uncertain, available just at the entrance to as you come out, and we hope all of you will be interested in that. Alongside the untruth reference and appeal, I'd like also to mention a truth, and that is that things in some ways have gone very well for us. 118 people now are members of our presidential cabinet. Your attendance suggests a kind of interest and concern with the problems that are addressed within this room, but we still have a considerable distance to go. And one of the truths is that the continuation of discussions like this, even with all the goodwill of people like Robert, who have shown this over the years, and one reason I'm so enthusiastic about his appeal for civil society and the good life is that he showed that in the negotiations we had in the midst of the snowstorm, should he come or shouldn't he come. And there was a warmth and a concern not only for us but for all the multiple factors you have to weigh, including his children, would they get to school if the storm didn't come, that made me think that this kind of a discussion is not only one on the economy, but really is a discussion on life itself. And for that reason, with enthusiasm about our 118 subscribers, I have great hope that there'll be, from this audience, a considerable number of you who also will want to join our presidential cabinet and make possible the continuation of what we've had this morning. Maybe you'd want to leave before, if there's to be a signing and if there are books.
All I can say is I don't know how many books they order, but I'm sure they did not order this many books. Naturally, I hope you all buy 10 or 12 copies, and if they're not here, you might order them, and then you could tell all your friends to buy it. Maybe my kids will get into college. I'll go back there if anybody actually does want to buy it.